every word is.
Oh my God! Yeah, you have me scared. Can we lower the lights a little bit? Thank you. Good morning. First, an infomercial. I have to hold a respectful distance to this frightful instrument, whose size is inversely proportionate to its powers, which is true of Napoleon and various other people too. I would like to make a few comments on the midterm, and I've had a chance to talk about them with Britt, because I wanted to save you from misunderstandings which would arise from the gap of generations. Therefore, we have divided up the midterms, and Britt has read half, I have read the other half, purely arbitrary, the division, and we are now going to confer with one another what our impressions are and so forth, and but we can only do that now that we have read them, and therefore it will be on Friday that we talk about it. My general impression is that the midterms gave me the conviction that you've been looking into these things. Now, this may be a delusion of old age, but it could also be the bare truth. I would feel strongly inclined that instead of putting you through a second ringer of exam, that we would concentrate our efforts and expect a good performance with your papers, so that in the end, instead of having to submit the papers as we had originally suggested at the beginning of December, you would add some time so that you could submit them after you've had your final review in your studio courses, and we will then read them after that. I would like you to hold your breath until Friday, when Britt and I will both have had a chance to discuss the midterms in greater detail, and when we will have established exactly what that exam date or day is that is going to be assigned to this class, and at which point I would like you to submit your papers. So much for that. We will come back to it on Friday. Like our previous examples, and these were, to remind you, if necessary, Le Corbusier's Maison La Roche-Jeanneret in Paris, Melnikov's house in Moscow, and Terragni's Casa del Fascio in Como. Like these examples, our fourth, the Johnson Wax Company administration building, belongs to a clear, well-established category of buildings. And, like the former, the building is a part of a considerably larger physical setting, and of course it's bound up with a broad vision of society. The urban residences we looked at imply the modern city. They react specifically to its context. In fact, they recreate some of the recent features of urban life within their own ambit. They are not only, as the term react to might have falsely implied, responding to something which exists entirely beyond and independent of them, but rather they participate in the full-fledged emergence of what one could call a truly modern metropolitan culture. The Casa del Fascio, you recall, raised issues about the place of architecture within the political realm, a realm that also became increasingly urban in precisely those decades. And now, the Johnson Wax Company buildings, and there are actually two, as you will see, address modern organization and the management of industry while extending its ideal reach to the country at large. This may sound like a tall claim, but you will see what I mean in a moment. The focus doesn't seem to me to be altogether too great, but the entrance, the central portions of the building are before you on your right, and they represent a first phase that I'll describe in a moment, and the second phase that almost without transition emerges from the first one is then that signature tower, the so-called Johnson Wax Company Research Tower. The claims I just made, you'll recognize in a moment, are not just generalities. When I was talking about the extraordinary range of these projects with regard to geography and society, with regard to the land and the people, I was emphasizing that these aspects are intrinsic to the work and not just simply something that could be garnished around them. That this is so, I will discuss in detail. In the early years of the century, Wright designed a major building in Buffalo for the Larkin Company, a successful mail order house. And with this building, which I apologize, I can't show you, it's that brick-clad box with corner towers, a major structure of the first half of the 20th century in America that's been demolished, like a number of others. You will find it in every book on Wright and in every halfway decent survey of 20th century American architecture. I apologize, I don't have it to hand right now, but take my word for it. It is a major building that steps into the tradition of large commercial structures established by Wright's former master, Louis Sullivan, who pioneered the development of such buildings and left precisely in Buffalo the famous Garanti building that you have seen when we talked about the two significant high-rises of Louis Sullivan in St. Louis and in Buffalo in 1895. So it just barely a decade between Sullivan's great example, clearly the upshot of late 19th century development of commercial building, and Wright's work in Buffalo in the first decade of the 20th century. The Larkin, which was built between 1902 and 1906, was a new foray for Wright, promising clients of superior standing and resources, such as Wright sought all his life. Commissions, such as the Larkin, and then later on those we're looking at, and contacts with potent clients spurred the architect on to make grand plans and to seize the opportunity to extend his reach well beyond a single building. He felt, in fact, a deep personal affinity for self-made men and for powerful clients from the ambit of industry and commerce who had the determination to shape not only individual projects, whatever they may have been, but in fact the will to shape their own destiny. Samuel Curtis Johnson had bought a hardware company and turned one of its minor products into a gold mine, floor wax. After 1917, Johnson shed the rest of the production line and specialized exclusively in floor waxes and paints. Following a familiar pattern, it was the grandson of the founder who launched the idea of giving the company a new hub in the form of an administration building located across the street from the old manufacturing plant. To an extent, this decision recognized that marketing and distribution now took a place equal to that of manufacturing. The new administration building, rather than the plant itself, was to give Johnson Wax its public presence and its publicity face. For these reasons, Johnson was dissuaded by his top managers to entrust the job to a local architect who had already been on and off doing work for this client. Moves behind the scene arranged for Johnson to meet the architect at Taliesin, likewise in Wisconsin, like Racine, the seat of the company. One of the men accompanying Johnson recalled the experience of the meeting between architect and client as, and I quote him, a shocker. The architect, ensconced in his sprawling house, received Johnson as if he were a petitioner and at once urged that the task should not be, and I quote again, to build on the site adjacent to the ugly old factory, but to raise everything and get out of town 4 or 5 miles west, run in a railroad spur, plan a Johnson village around a new factory and office building, houses for employees, their own shopping center, the works. A tall order, to say the least. Wright, almost out of work during these first years of the Depression, had just developed his grandiose plans, and we will look at them on Friday, among other things, for Broadacre City, which he exhibited in New York in 1935. A few years earlier, with little else to do, he had established the Taliesin Fellowship, hoping to attract devoted young followers who would not only work for free, but also subsidize Taliesin by paying a hefty fee for the privilege of working and studying under the guidance of the old prophetic master architect. Surrounded by his boys and taking his guests through his splendid estate, Wright was in his element, playing chieftain to his tribe. Johnson, the client, recalled the visit and said, "I showed him pictures of the old office, and he said it was awful." Wright had a Lincoln Zephyr, and I had one. That was the only thing we agreed on. On all other matters, we were at each other's throats. One can just imagine how Wright's display of hospitality and his ownership of the same luxury-level car his wealthy client owned put the architect symbolically, as it were, on an equal footing with his reluctant client. Wright hoped to bring Johnson around to his idea of building an entire company town from scratch, so as to realize a token of the Broadacre plan into which he had invested so much work in the dry preceding seasons, and he hoped to persuade Johnson to think in expansive and ambitious terms for his new headquarters. Johnson Wax was one of those industries that successfully turned an originally artisanal, one might almost say homemade, product into an industrial one. Marketing made the difference, but it was also a volatile thing, as Johnson was to learn quickly. Not only was floor wax easy to copy, it was one of the first things to skip in times of economic hardship, and we have entered a time of extreme economic hardship without parallel in the 20th century. Wright was also passing through lean years, and had it not been for his extensive trading in Japanese woodblock prints, tens of thousands passing through his hands, he could not have made ends meet, sustain his studio through the Depression years, and finally rope in two powerful clients, Johnson and the department store tycoon Edgar Kaufman. Johnson and Kaufman, or Kaufman, enabled him to build two enduring landmarks of American architecture, the Johnson Wax Company and Falling Water. Both of them at a remove, of course, geographically, from established centers. This is a trait, of course, familiar to you, particularly from the history of American architecture, that there is a kind of dispersal in many instances rather than a concentration of works in one or two or three places, as is far more typical of the terribly centralized countries of Western Europe. Working for these two clients, Johnson and Kaufman, it's very funny, you know, even their letters follow in the alphabet. There was some sort of strange riddle of fate in this. Working for these two clients, one might say that Wright managed to industrialize his own architecture in the process. Broadacre City certainly envisaged a pattern of settlement that was no less radical in its own terms than was Le Corbusier's contemporary concept of the Ville Radieuse. They are absolutely contemporary and independent from one another. Of course, you recall the ideas of the Ville Radieuse based on isolated, freestanding, very widely spaced major residential towers, on a separation of traffic on the land, on a grand axis and vistas. And Broadacre City, if you want, is in large measure the exact opposite of this, that is to say, a kind of extension and continuation of the Jeffersonian grid, subdivided into what could only be described by their surface as minimum subsistence farms and individual residential buildings of a number of uniform types with great highways leading to this extremely sparse distribution of the settlements and a few major accents thrown in for good measure in order to give space to administrative, public institutions, sports, and the like. So if one brings an extreme concentration of the population in massive structures, which then, of course, for that price, as it were, buy a lot of open space, Wright imagined a kind of even seeding of the land, very much an old rural American ideal. I don't know where they actually get that idea. We all know that the morals on the farm are by no means higher than they are in the city, and it's not only due to the presence of hawks. But that's the idea, right? That if you keep people sufficiently thinly dispersed, that then somehow that will be beneficial for them. Where, of course, the opposite, that extreme concentration of the population may in turn also implode or explode or lead to its own limits. But it's interesting to see that these two concepts, Broadacre City and Ville Radieuse, make for that extraordinary polarity, not only between America and Europe as cultural entities, but also make for extraordinary polarities with regard to the prevalent nature of political institutions, the tendencies implicit and explicit in the body politic on these two continents and whatever happened in between them. In fact, they're so explicit, nobody would ever ask them, at least I wouldn't, in an exam, because it'd be too simple, like asking what's the difference between mother and father. Neither did the Johnson Wax Company administration building fall short of the ambition of creating a seat of industrial power. Now, that's very important. Comparable to the simultaneous labors expanded on creating seats of political power in Europe. That's one of the reasons, however lopsided the comparison may be in many other respects, why I had chosen the Casa del Fascio by Terragni, that is just completed when the work at the Johnson Wax is being started in 1936. I don't want to stretch this juxtaposition between an industrial hub in America and a political seat in Europe too far, but I think that these ambitions were on a par, and with regard to their consequences, notwithstanding their profound differences, they certainly are comparable. Whereas Germany or Italy lacked little in ideological organization, they proved inferior in the end in industrial production. The coming war, to which every signpost pointed in the later 1930s, the coming war was based on ideological grounds and organized as political crusades, as conquest of other nations, as expansion of the so-called Lebensraum to the east. The war on Russia to the east was essentially to slice off a major segment of Eurasia in order to provide a new staging area for the grand plans of the Western European fascistoid powers. So if the coming war was based on ideological grounds and organized, as I said, as a political crusade, it was nonetheless won in the end by American industrial superiority. This is not to make light of the strategic cunning and the bravery of the Americans in their conquest of Europe, even though there are many moments when you have reason to doubt where that went at that moment. I think in retrospect, of course, easy to say many of these things, but it is amazing, you know, how extraordinarily poorly the amphibious assault in Normandy worked. You know, film about, what was it, Looking for Private Ryan, or what it was called, gave you a horrific replay of something which might almost have failed. So you wonder, you know, if you take all this time and you plan everything and you do have this incredible mass of materiel and manpower at your hands, that this should turn into such a carnage on the beach. Or, for instance, well advanced in the campaign, although aided and abetted by fog, the disastrous losses in the Ardennes offensive in December of 1944, the last gasp of Nazi military resistance of a significant kind, where American deaths were something like 10,000 in 3 days. I mean, very hard to understand. But in the end, of course, the war was won. The war was won by the fact that for every wrecked jeep, that 10 others could be supplied. For every plane shot down, 10 new planes could be launched, whereas, of course, German industrial production after the mid-1944 took such a nosedive that in the end you can say the war was very largely a war of materiel, and one side had all of it that it could possibly want, and the other, of course, less and less of it. Well, it was hard. I think it's interesting in this context to contemplate this fact of the extraordinary rise of American industry that permitted, with all the extraordinary difficulties accruing to an intervention across an ocean, permitted America to win the Second World War. Well, it was hardly floor wax that did the job. Johnson clearly organized his company to conquer the world with polish. Wright's role in this momentous process should perhaps be cut back to size. I'm not saying that America won the war because Frank Lloyd Wright's Johnson Wax Building, but it was a remarkable accomplishment nonetheless. After the initial construction of the administration building, which has been rotting visually in front of you, Wright added a second element that turned into a signature piece and an icon for the future of industry, the research tower. It's very interesting that, you know, you go from the factory which blows steam and dust and heat in its surroundings to a production of wax, and then to the development of wax and paints and solvents and everything else that is indispensable for the industrial development, a research-based expansion of something that started with a simpler thing as a mixture of petrol and beeswax. Beeswax, I think, has this... What is it? Beeswax has this kind of colloquial association with something made held together with beeswax. Dubious. So bridging the times of war and peace, Wright kept pushing his own work in a direction that led, perhaps unintentionally but predictably, to the grand post-war schemes such as the Civic Center of Marin County in Northern California and other schemes of Wright, and the post-war elaboration of Broadacre City, which then gets populated with these funny little buzzing helicopters that that seem to spread their wings like dragon, their blades like dragonflies, and swirl over the Broadacre farms, bringing Auntie Emily back to her origins and roots. And on the streets run those strange vehicles, which seem straight out of H.G. Wells, with gigantic rear wheels and tiny little front wheels, making a kind of strange chairs that the fellows at Taliesin West then, by that time, were endlessly spinning out to give this kind of new futurist lease of life to Wright's original ideas. But in January of 1938, if you think of that, 1928, 1929, the Depression, the early 30s, a period of extraordinary difficulty and drought in the office of Wright gets progressively forgotten because in these years, quite other projects, some of which we'll see next Friday, steal attention away from this by now, you know, very elderly genius. Then come Johnson and Kaufman, and by January 1938, Wright made the cover of Time magazine, having created landmark buildings during one of the most difficult decades of the century, when, in his own words, in Wright's own words, he sought to make, and I quote him, a rational attempt to integrate art and industry and correlate both with everyday life in America, capitalizing art, industry, and America. In his own script. It's interesting. Of course, this is nothing but a rather familiar refrain, right? A replay of the program of the Bauhaus, a retaking of the program of Cranbrook, the program of the century, if you want, beginning with the Werkbund and the debates around what the new relationship is going to be between the arts and architecture and society, no longer individually mediated by craft as much as collectively mediated by industry. So now we're getting closer and closer. Don't despair. I'm trying another way every time. The Johnson Wax Company administration building appears to be made of ribbons of brick, separated by strips of glass. The central slightly luminous line is, of course, nothing but the gutter of the book from which the image has been scanned. But what you see immediately is that overall the building, both seen a little bit from further away and from close up, is made, one could say it, and Wright said it almost literally himself, by ribbons of brick separated by strips of glass. Everything is taut and continuous, defined by stretched surfaces that wrap the entire building on all levels, and that seemingly smoothly and effortlessly either bend around volumes or merge with cubic flat surfaces of cubic volumes in a discontinuous stretching and enveloping of the building on all levels. If cylindrical volumes, and you can see them protrude on the right-hand side, and if we saw this from above, and you will see later a drawing, you'll see that there are two symmetrically placed of these turret-like elements that extend further, the kind of ziggurat-like, the stepped shape of the building. Another element that provides the structural key for the building after these enveloping ribbons is, of course, a kind of mushroom column, as you have already seen it, and as you can see it particularly clearly here in the entrance part, the lowest part, where you come in. Of course, you notice at once that the water is missing from the circular pools on the left-hand side, but that may have the advantage of drawing your attention to the fact that these columns sit on cast and bronzed metal feet and rise from a 9-inch diameter at the foot with a hollow stem articulated by these necking rings as the diameter expands to what on top right called petals, which is wide, flat discs. The columns are of three different heights. You will also see technical drawings, while the petals remain at an approximately uniform diameter. Wright called the columns dendriform, that's to say tree-shaped. You have heard the term dendrochronology, no doubt. A systematic mapping of the growth pattern in trees on various continents that add up to a sort of calendrical meter, so that you can, from any section of any kind of wood, when you read through the years of growth, those more or less concentric rings of a tree, that you can then find on your running scale of growth patterns across the centuries that exact sequence of trees which corresponds and dates the piece of wood that you are trying to identify as to the period of its growth. So that's called dendrochronology, from dendros and chronos, and from tree and time, the tree in time. What Wright is referring to by dendriform, a kind of a slightly awkward word, is that it has the shape of a tree or a tree trunk or a tree profile of a tree. And he borrowed from botany further to name three of the four segments of the column: stem, petal, and calyx. Calyx is the part that, of course, expands like in a champagne glass. There are two kinds of champagne glasses, right? The more proletarian form is flat and low, letting out the bubble at once, where the more elegant and pretentious is the calyx, the narrow and tall, which actually holds the effervescent state of the champagne for a longer time, presumably implying you take more time to drink it, whereas with the other one, you just go and have the effect. So the dendriform column not only organizes the building, here you can see, look across this court porte cochere as the cars would approach, and you enter in the under the lowest version of these trees. And, of course, we'll talk about in a minute about the story of this column is. The dendriform column not only organizes the building, it also implies a specific concept of space. Of course, the column needed to survive a serious load test, for which Wright, the true shaman of his art, was present, so as to demonstrate publicly and celebrate his superior power and wisdom. The column in the end did collapse, but it collapsed because of the uneven distribution of weight and the ramshackle supports which held up the rim of the column. The column itself, in fact, proved to be unbelievably strong. Of course, it had to be very carefully constructed, reinforced with steel mesh, and with a special pump and shaking, a continuous rotation of the form in which the column was being cast, so that indeed it did possess remarkable structural properties. By far, the largest space in the building harks back in function to Wright's earliest design of an administration building. The Larkin in Buffalo was organized around a central workspace rising through the full height of the building, as here, considerably higher, almost double, with lateral floor trays accommodating various management offices. So the central pool, both at Larkin and here, is lit from the top, or in the case of the Larkin, it was lit since it doesn't exist anymore. And, of course, it was supposed to be, particularly at Larkin, was supposed to be uplifting with inspirational inscriptions and even occasional speakers giving pep talks from the balconies. Wright had designed the building down to its smallest detail, every inscription, every ornament. Of course, he did no less for the Johnson Company. In the intervening years, both Peter Behrens and Hans Poelzig in Germany designed comparable spaces, comparable in size and purpose, for an industrial administration building in Frankfurt, the case of Behrens, and a central radio station, in the case of Poelzig, for Berlin. Miraculously, that central radio station in Berlin escaped bombing, and in fact, it's absolutely horrendous if you think about it. Something very difficult to understand how this, of all, with strategic bombing, with bombing with precise targeting of certain areas. Why the huge? You could see it from 10 kilometers up from the air, easily made out on the map of Berlin. The curiously shaped, enormous state radio building was never directly bombed. And in January and February of 1945, if you can imagine, recordings were made with new types of electro microphones of German folk songs by Peter Anders, a remarkable young tenor in Germany, who also recorded a great repertoire of other buildings. Recording sessions had to be continually interrupted for bomb alarms and other things. Some curious background noises infiltrating into the recordings and being actually audible on archive edition of these songs. Now, this is an entirely unrelated observation, which I cannot simply pass over, because whenever I see that building, or I've been in it, and think of it, I cannot think forget this irony of history. The all-inclusive approach of Wright and Behrens, clearly you remember Behrens and the AEG, signaled the advent of a new chapter in corporate design. But these European examples were probably in the end less important for Wright than was his own design for a newspaper plant in Salem, Oregon. You see the ground plan above and a elevation below. That was not built. Designed in 1931-32, the entire ground floor space was already organized by a version of the same dendriform columns, and the space partially lit from above, and in this case also from the side. At the Johnson Wax Company, here is the elevation, which makes very, very clear the fundamentally symmetrical layout and this horizontal banding, which combines with a setback and cigarette-like effect you can see in the aerial view, and in the cutaway view, which is obviously not designed by Frank Lloyd Wright himself, but which may be helpful in figuring out what I'm saying about, and will be saying in greater detail, about the relationship between the space inside formed by these columns and the banding on the facade, as you see it here too. But let's go back to this. At the Johnson Wax Company, these elements achieve preeminence over any other. At Salem, Oregon, in a newspaper plant, they emerge. They are prominent, but they're not preeminent. More than that, they are cast in unison. 18 foot high, you saw it a moment ago, 18 foot high, the columns form a kind of glen. What is a glen? A glen is really a husbanded stand of regularly spaced trees. Because it's forestry. A glen is the result of forestry rather than to be the irregular thicket that nature produces as a wild forest. Of course, wild forest is in Europe, for instance, left to very, very few places, while most stands of trees are the result of forestry. It is these regularly placed 18-foot high columns that filter the light from the sky. Laterally, the space is fully enclosed by walls, which reinforced by upstairs landings and balconies, you can see them run in the background, contain an otherwise what could only be called a diffuse space. As Wright himself put it, glass tubing laid up like bricks in a wall composes all the lighting surfaces. He continued, we went up in the air around a giant central stack with floors branching from it. He wrote, having clear light and space all around each floor. Now, this is a reference to the research tower, but it also summarizes, except for the multiple floors, the nature of the space as we have seen it, and you see it here again in the cutaway. This is no longer the directional space of Wright's early houses, no longer the cantilevered awnings and the low roofs overhanging a series of windows. Now, space assumes the character of a pool with all what is implied including potential leaks. It even acquires the character of an aquarium, as has been suggested. But the age-old association with trees clings to the idea of its new of their new employment. When he extended the concept, as I said, of the column to an entire building, as he did for the research tower of the company, he spoke there of the floor slabs spread out like tree branches, cantilevered from the giant stack. Now here we have seen that the column becomes very clear in these technical drawings, indicating the different heights, showing you that they are hollow, both in the stem and in the tapering disc, with the necking rings forming that transition once taken in earlier versions, I'll come to that at once, by the mushroom column. So this is, here is genuine, original, interesting, very efficient and economical engineering for you. Where open space, where space is open to the extent right permitted, enclosure and insulation become pressing problems. The architect needed to think of an entirely new way of realizing his idea. Exploring the available materials for glazing, because you have to cover all the intervals between the discs in the ceiling, and of course all the horizontal bands that open between the enveloping brickwork. Exploring the available materials for glazing, he hit upon Pyrex tubes, fitting them to form a continuous wall, as he said, proved, however, a major challenge. Corning Glass Company, the producers of Pyrex, which became popular for cookingware and chemical laboratory equipment, contributed substantially to the technical solution, which is here illustrated on the screen. It was decided to fix Pyrex tubing in aluminum sockets, and you can see these sockets laterally, and to insulate the tube with strips of mastic specially shaped to fit between the tubes. So between each tube, the workman is just applying one of these mastic bands, which then compressed closely by the individual Pyrex tubes forms an air and watertight barrier. Although it's quite clear, and as the final result proves, particularly on the roof, it was necessary to yet glaze the outside of these surfaces once more to shield them from the immediate impact and the changes also in part of temperature and the behavior of the mastic under rain and snow. This process, however, allowed for these continuous strips of light to outline and emphasize the smooth continuity of curvilinear shapes in the building, prompting Wright to remark that light enters the building where the cornice used to be. We'd have to jump back a little bit, you might recall. You see, it's particularly in the upper left-hand corner with the largest, slightly extruded profile of the continuous band lighting the big interior spaces at the edge of the building. That it's clear that he was making more than just a symbolic comparison when he said light enters the building where the cornice used to be. And what did the cornice do when it used to be employed? Well, the cornice, of course, framed, contained, and crowned the building. So what here has taken the place of that framing, containing, and crowning is light. Light, which particularly, and therefore always the preference to photograph the building at a time when the internal light really is is readable on the outside of the building, morning and night, as you see it here, that this effect is made particularly clear. Wright had to tackle two very different problems. The structural column and the envelope required to enclose the space created with and between these columns. In the end, both the column and the Pyrex tubing are stems, use stems, or what one could say by some stretching of the word, more accurately actually hoses. One is a fixed and rigid translucent hose, the tube, and the other one is one that obviously can expand, change its diameter, and accommodate mass, volume, and reinforcement, and therefore turns into a column. So one could, in a sense, say this whole building is made of one fundamental conceptual element that is so specialized and transformed that once it serves a structural and once it serves this kind of enclosing and filtering process. Whereas the hollow column is gaining strength from its flaring shape, recalling the primitive origins of Maillard's patented method of reinforcing mushroom columns that you see on the upper left-hand side in a warehouse in Zurich from 1923, Wright's dendriform column, again in the drawing on the lower right, finds its companion, as I said, in the Pyrex tube. Just as the former, the column, can be of varying height, like trees, rather than columns in the classical definition, which of course have to be uniform, the latter, Pyrex tubes, can vary in diameter and be strung around an entire building as they were in the administration building and later on in the Johnson Wax Tower. The cream-colored columns appear even lighter, or should one say lithe, against the deep brick red of surrounding walls. Every surface has its color, The desks are covered in baked enamel. I think we got one of those too here. Yeah, very colorful. The walls stained and varnished. The floors tiled. Everything is predicated upon this contrast, which lends a suspended and almost floating quality to the columns, and a suffused and vaguely submerged one to the space. I mean, this association that seems to surface again and again in various people's reaction and description, that this is like an aquarium or something, that space is liquid. These are like this lily stems, water lilies growing and forming on the surface of a liquid, this roof of discs. Columns, of course, can also, in fact, I said before, be reasonably likened to these champagne glasses, which in turn contain liquid and carry that association even further. In the midst of the war, Wright designed a second signature piece for the company, and of course that was the 15-story research tower, which was completed in 1950. Delayed greatly by the immediate post-war difficulties with materials and so forth, and the due in part to the innovative concept of the structure. Conceived as a massive central stem from which different floor trays extend in alternating sequence, as very clear here, the circular trays alternating with the squarish ones, with rounded corners, of course, the tower carries the motif of bands in brick and membranes of Pyrex glass to new heights. The research tower caps a secular development of industry, housing it appropriately in a building that matches its internal vertical thrust by external horizontal banding. Wright was a persuasive spokesman for his own idea when he wrote, "The building itself became crystal, where crystal, either transparent or translucent, was felt to be the most appropriate." In other words, here, crystal is the signature of this new level that industry is aiming for, and that Wright, in a sense, anticipates in the nature of this research tower, which nonetheless, on the other hand, seems, though a second and independent planned element, to tune in very well with the earlier phase of the mid and later 1930s. We'll stay in that time period and look elsewhere on Friday. Thank you.